Our next case for argument this morning is MMG Financial Corporation against Midwest Amusement Park.
May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Nett and I represent the appellant Midwest Amusement Park in this matter.
You're going to have to raise your voice.
Okay.
Don't adjust the microphones, just raise your voice.
Okay. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Nett and I represent the appellant defendant Midwest Amusement Park in this matter. This case involves a transaction that was supposed to be the beginning of a highly profitable arrive and drive program for the amusement park and its racetrack. Appellee MMG and its agent McMaster made representations that they were selling the amusement park a phenomenally successful arrive and drive package, which included the program, the go-karts, distributorship rights for go-kart parts, and the final icing was they were going to finance the package. The financing was to be competitive and reasonable. And with the package they were selling, Midwest was to expect substantial revenues in its first season. The amusement park relied on these representations and placed its order for the arrive and drive program and go-karts. Given the convoluted events that occurred after that, it's valid to ask if there was a contract here. The jury found that, yes, there was a contract, but the terms are in dispute. It is our position the only contract that should have been deemed and used as according to its terms was the contract that was signed by at least one party. The initial proposed draft was never signed by anybody. After renegotiation, a draft was signed by my client. The other side never did sign that draft either, or that final agreement. That agreement stated that interest was at 12%. And that my client was to pay 50% of the revenue from its arrive and drive program to the appellee as payment for the go-karts and the program. And at the time the initial contract was signed by my client, they did not know at that time that they were going to have substantial warranty problems, that the carts were going to blow up, half of them were going to blow up at the first time around their track, and that a lot of the others were going to fall apart. And they also didn't know that the warranty was going to become useless. All parties, including MMG, agreed that the sole purpose for my clients placing this order for this arrive for these go-karts was to begin a highly profitable arrive and drive program. The bottom line is it never happened. The contract was breached by MMG initially because the arrive and drive program was never delivered. The go-karts were supposed to arrive fully assembled by the beginning of the 2005 karting season, which was June 1st, and they were supposed to be with engines broken in and ready for service in the United States. And instead, they were delivered nearly 2 months later, unassembled, and then after some scrambling, the vendor had to come down from Canada and put those carts together, but they were not broken in. After the carts broke down and my client tried to proceed with the obtaining warranty for their product, suddenly they discovered from the vendor that the vendor's arguing, we've never been paid, we're not going to service these carts.
Counsel, bottom line in this case, it appears as though the relationship between your client and NMG was a financial arrangement.
Correct.
And although there may be some underlying suspicion that there were relationships between the vendor and the financier, How do you establish that MMG was responsible for this quality of the product or the upkeep of the product or the other issues that you raised?
Because from the very beginning, Midwest dealt with MMG. They dealt with McMaster, who is the agent for both the cart vendor and he was the financing arm of the cart vendor. The contract that was signed on its face states that it's a conditional sales agreement, and it states in the contract that it's for the for the purchase of go-karts. So the financing is also a part of this, but so also was the purchase of the carts themselves. And even after the carts began to break down initially, my client did also still go back to MMG with the problem that had occurred. And eventually he referred them to Cameron, who is the vendor side of the deal. But initially every contact was with MMG. And the bottom line, though, is that the judgment for $190,000 that was entered against Midwest in the trial court is contrary to the weight of evidence in law, because the evidence demonstrated that the interest rate was 12%. The judgment that was entered was at 24%. That's a difference of around $60,000. That interest rate was against the weight of the evidence and Wisconsin law. And like I said, the purported contract was for the sale of goods. And even though there was financing terms included in it that involved MMG, it was also for the sale of goods, and that the financing section cannot negate the sale of goods. So the statute of frauds should have applied, which would have meant the contract that was signed by at least one party, it should have been the final contract that should have been used.
Counsel, what statute of frauds are you referring to?
Actually, Wisconsin Statute 402.
The one in Article 2 of the UCC?
Yes.
Why is that pertinent?
Because it was for
it has to do with the sale of goods. The contracted issue in this case is a contract for the lending of money.
That is correct, but that same contract is also for the purchase of the go-karts. And it says right on its face it's the conditional sales agreement. It wasn't just for financing, and that's where we argue that the statute of fraud should have applied. And despite that, the agreement...
Is there some Wisconsin case you're relying on for the proposition that the statute of frauds for the sale of goods applies to a lender?
You know, I could not find anything to that effect.
How about in some other state?
No.
I think there's a reason why you couldn't find them.
The agreed-upon interest rate, though, was still 12%. The parties agreed to it, and McMaster even acknowledged that. The invoices that MMG sent to my client were at 12%. The only contract form that had a signature was at 12%. And Wisconsin law prohibits an unlicensed party from lending at more than 18%. So, at best...
Counsel, did you plead usury as an affirmative defense?
I don't think so.
Isn't it an affirmative defense under state law?
Yes.
And you know that the federal rules say that affirmative defenses are waived if not timely pleaded.
And the other issue, too, was the MMG is arguing that my client was not allowed to address the payment, the issue of whether MMG had actually paid cash for those go-karts and had actually financed the transaction. The district court, even at trial, addressed that. In fact, that issue had not been determined at summary judgment and was therefore validly before the trial court and before this court. The other issue, too, is the evidence that was not admitted at trial. It was a summary of all of the outstanding invoices of the vendor that had not been paid to the cart manufacturer, and the district court disallowed that from being admitted into evidence because it had been sent via email, and they determined it was inadmissible hearsay. Business records, though, are still covered by the business record exception to hearsay rule, even when delivered via email. The fact that that was not admitted also severely prejudiced my client. The jury was unable to see any written evidence that refuted MMG's testimony and their purported evidence of payment.
Counsel, was that a part of a contract, or was it simply the rendition in a letter form of what your client believed that the contract was?
No, this was after the cards had been delivered and assembled, this was a email that was actually sent from the cart manufacturer to both the appellee and the Cameron.
But it wasn't their record. It was their assessment of what their record showed.
But to the extent that it addressed all business records, and to the extent that it was a record showing here's your outstanding invoices, that it was a business record, and it was sent to MMG, so who had it from the get-go, before this case was even commenced, and businesses are certainly allowed to, you know, create business records that state what is still owed on their accounts, and those are still deemed business records.
So are you suggesting that if I get a letter from a bank saying that you owe us X amount of dollars, that document, that letter, is equivalent to a ledger of the payments that I've made and what I have not paid?
No, but this wasn't just a letter. I mean, it was also a charted summary of each invoice, which, again, was a business record, and the exact status of it all, you know, to that point in time. I just want to say one more thing so I don't use all my rebuttal time, but the granting of summary judgment was also improper because the letters and deposition testimony that was presented by my client were allowable documents because they were able to be substantiated at trial. And, in fact, the Grunwald, who presented deposition testimony, and Cameron, whose letters had been directed to Grunwald and were submitted to the court, both did attend the trial and did testify, so that those documents were substantiated at trial. And the deposition testimony that Grunwald made about non-payment was based on his personal observation. So it was not out of the air. It was not speculation. It was based on his personal experience and observation in trying to get warranty service. With that, I'll see.
Thank you, Ms. Nett. Mr. Schmidt.
May it please the Court, my name is Wick Schmidt, and I represent the plaintiff and the appellee in this case, MMG Financial Corporation. I just wanted to touch real briefly on a few points that I think are salient here. First is, this is one of the most irritating things to me after dealing with this case for 3.5 years, Midwest is trying to have it both ways here. From the time they answered our original...
Let's try to have that both. Have things three ways, four ways if they can.
From the time they answered our original complaint up until the morning of the first day of the trial, their position here was, Midwest's position that is, was there was a contract between the parties, the contract called for repayment of interest at 12% and for repayment at 50% of the racetrack's revenues, and that is a contract between the parties. And incidentally, that was the contract that they claimed in their counterclaims that MMG breached. On the morning of the first day of trial, they came in and discovered suddenly that the person who entered into this contract wasn't an agent or employee of Midwest Amusement Park, LLC. And then this individual made the further interesting discovery that he never, in fact, entered into the contract. I just wanted to real briefly quote for the Court some of the things Mr. Cal Granville, who was Midwest's negotiator on this contract, said. Asked him, so from the beginning of the discussions to the end of them, you never had an agreement or a contract, oral or written, is that correct? His answer was, that's correct. another place, I was asked whether Mr. McMaster had ever agreed to his knowledge to the proposal embraced by Trial Exhibit 2. And Trial Exhibit 2 is the document that the conditional sales agreement that Midwest now claims was the contract between the parties. And Mr. Granville's answer to that question was no. And now they come into court and say, oh, yeah, well, that conditional sales agreement, Trial Exhibit 2, was, in fact, after all, the contract between the parties. Well, if that was their position, they should have offered testimony to that effect at trial. The repeated denials of the jury heard from Mr. Granville that that contract was ever agreed to probably had the effect of convincing the jury that it was not, in fact, agreed to. Mr. McMaster's testimony on the point was simply that he told Mr. Granville that that proposal might be acceptable to him if he received some payments. Mr. McMaster went on to say that he never received a single payment from Midwest. So I think there was ample evidence from which the jury could have found either A, that there was never, in fact, a contract between the parties, an agreement to reduce the interest rate from 24% or 2% per month to 12% or 1% a month. And the jury could also have found that because there was a proposal that was made by Midwest 6 or 7 months after they received the carts and MMG had paid for the carts, that there was no consideration for this modification of one party's obligations after the other party had fully performed. There was a lot of discussion about the letter. It was actually an email that Bob Cameron, who was a surprise witness on the day of trial, supposedly received from somebody in Italy summarizing Team Hurricane Incorporated's outstanding balance with CRG. Just to give a little bit of background here, CRG is an Italian company that manufactured the go-karts in question. Team Hurricane Incorporated is the go-kart dealer of which Mr. Cameron was a principal and of which Mr. McMaster was supposed to be a principal. Unfortunately, Mr. Cameron did not set the company up that way, and that is the topic of a separate case up in Canada that I will not go into. But this email was supposedly sent by some gentleman in Italy to Mr. Cameron to summarize the supposed outstanding balance on Team Hurricane, the cart dealer's account with CRG, the cart maker. Putting aside the question of whether that email is hearsay or not, it's completely irrelevant. It was a rabbit trail that wasted probably a quarter of the time on the first day of trial, the argument back and forth over this question of whether CRG had been paid for the carts, and the consistent insinuations of the fact that it had not been, if in fact it had not been, was somehow Mr. McMaster's fault. The contract at issue in this case does not obligate MMG to pay CRG for Team Hurricane's debt with CRG. The contract at issue in this case obligated MMG to pay Midwest's debt with Team Hurricane, THI. And there's no evidence offered, certainly not at the summary judgment stage, which is the stage in which this was decided, that MMG did not, in fact, do that. In fact, if you look at Trial Exhibit 1, I mean, of all the pieces of evidence that were entered in at trial, this is, I believe, the clearest. This is Team Hurricane's invoice, and it says right at the bottom, MMG tendered the full amount of the cart purchase, balance due zero. I mean, that was Mr. Cameron admitted on the stand. That was his own invoice. And for people to come in after all this time and say that this bill was not paid by MMG to Team Hurricane, I think is sort of ridiculous. There was also an argument made, and again, this was resolved in summary judgment, that there was somehow breach of warranty liability on MMG for problems with the carts. There probably were some problems with the carts. I think they're exaggerated in some of the unsupported statements in the appellant's brief here when they say that people were nearly killed by these carts or something. I think there were also some maintenance issues on appellant's ends that contributed mightily to those problems. But whether there were problems with the carts or not, the thing to do over that is to sue Team Hurricane. There's really no explanation for why MMG is liable for a breach of warranty by Team Hurricane. The mere fact, assuming it is a fact, that Mr. McMaster was also acting on behalf of Team Hurricane, and the cart order, incidentally, was not placed with Mr. McMaster. The testimony is quite clear that the carts were ordered by Cal Granville through an individual by the name of Lauren Kelly, who was an employee either of Team Hurricane or of Cameron Motorsports Incorporated, another of Bob Cameron's companies. But even assuming somehow that the cart purchase transaction was something that Mr. McMaster had done, that you know, Mr. McMaster may very well have been an agent of Team Hurricane, and that may very well be grounds for holding Team Hurricane liable, but it certainly provides no grounds for holding MMG liable any more than, say, if I were to enter into a contract on behalf of Liebman, Conway, Olneach, and Jerry, my law firm, it would provide grounds for holding other corporations of which I may be an agent or director liable on the contract I entered into on behalf of the law firm. So there's still no coherent explanation for why NMG would be liable for Team Hurricane's breaches of warranty. Another irritating statement I found, there's a claim made in both the initial and the reply brief, I believe, by appellant here, that the trial judge found that Mr. McMaster had committed perjury or noted puzzlement with Mr. McMaster's contradictions or something like that. There's no such statement made by the trial judge at the trial. This is on page 270 of the trial transcript. What the judge is commenting on at that point, this is in the middle of Mr. Cameron's examination, is the fact that when I had asked Mr. McMaster, MMG's principal, about the Team Hurricane invoice on the first day of trial, the judge had ruled that it could not come into evidence because there was no testimony that Mr. McMaster had any foundation to lay or had any knowledge of Team Hurricane's business records because he didn't have any ownership with the company. Mr. Cameron had now come down. Mr. Cameron had testified that he, Mr. Cameron, was an owner of the company and that I had been able to get Exhibit 1 in through Mr. Cameron's testimony because he said, this is my company, I know the invoices. And now Exhibit 1 has been admitted. So Judge Griesbach said, I originally kept it out because Mr. McMaster had denied me connection with the company. I've now let it in because Mr. Cameron has authenticated it as the principal of the company. The last point, I think, that was raised in the briefs were the hearsay issues on summary judgment with the letters that appellant Midwest supposedly received from Bob Cameron. I should note, incidentally, that those letters were never even properly authenticated at the summary judgment stage. They were exhibits to Mr. McMaster's deposition where Midwest's original counsel put them in front of Mr. McMaster and said, Mr. McMaster, are you aware that Mr. Cameron sent this letter or something to that effect? And Mr. McMaster said, no, I've never seen this before. That was how they got into the record. Original counsel for Midwest then attached the entire deposition of Mr. McMaster to her summary judgment response affidavit and cited to these letters. So there's no authentication that Midwest ever even received these letters, but whether it received them or not, more importantly, they're clearly hearsay, and I trust that the argument on that point is clear enough that the court can see it from the briefs. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Anything further, Ms. Knott?
Regardless of what Grunvold testified at trial, it doesn't change the facts. He argued there was no contract because at that point in time, Midwest was taking the position that there had been no contract because only one party had signed it and they had not received any benefit under it. So therefore, there should be no contract to which they were liable for. And as you said, everyone likes to get it both ways. But that contract that was signed was not 6 or 7 months later, as Appelli is indicating, because if it had been 6 or 7 months later, that was after the carts had broken down. That was after they discovered that they weren't getting any warranty service. If it was a modification at 6 or 7 months later, they most certainly would have had completely different terms or been arguing for different terms and certainly wouldn't have signed it the way it was signed. And the other thing in Appelli's reply brief, this issue of payment keeps coming up. They say they paid it. They say show the sheet showing, yes, the payment was tendered. But in their reply, in their Appelli brief, it very clearly states that cash was not paid, that they simply took and said the vendor owed, MMG said the vendor owes me money and subtracted that amount from the total that they say the vendor owed. Obviously, the vendor disagreed, and that is probably what started a lot of the problem here. And my client is left holding the bag. So we would request that the matter be reversed and remanded for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.